Hey everyone, I teamed up with David McCourt, the founder and CEO of McCourt Capital, to launch the Meltzer and McCourt Get Out and Vote Show every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern Time. Mr. McCourt and I will go live on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Make sure you join us for the most important election of our lives. All we ask is you get out and vote. Today's episode will feature Alan Miller, founder of the News Literacy Project, and Philip Stutz, the founder and CEO of Win Big Media. Let me know if you enjoyed today's episode and would like to hear more of the Meltzer and McCourt Show, and text me at 949-298-2905 to join our community. Remember, you can always email me at david@dmeltzer.com.
This is Entrepreneurs the Playbook.
All right, we are live, Mr. McCourt. We are here, the Meltzer and McCourt. It's the Get Out and Vote Never Before Seen edition.
Nice to be with you, David.
You know what? I guarantee this will be more entertaining than what's going to happen in a few hours. And one thing will be for sure, there'll be more facts given here that are truthful than facts that aren't. That's a guarantee. If anyone wants to bet me, just reach out to me, david@dmeltzer.com, because I'll take that bet any day of the week. And we have a special guest that also can verify that. Alan Miller will be on in a minute as well. But David, give us a little bit of background on how important this first debate is tonight.
Well, look, it's critical because it's a chance for both of them to deal with the answers to the same question. So it's a little harder to make up fake news when you have to answer the same question, both of you, right? And I don't think making fun of each other is going to really work tonight. I think they have to deal with, you know, what people want to hear about, which is the issues that matter to them. So I think it's going to be really important and really interesting. Must-see TV, right? Like, I'm in Europe. It's going to be 2 in the morning. I have to stay up at 2 in the morning to watch it, Dave.
But the bigger issue to me is, considering the base that Trump has, you know, what's the objective for Trump of a big win? What would be his objective? And then also for Biden, what's the objective for him during the debate? Because they have to be completely, you know, polar to each other and completely diverse, but they each should have their own objective. What do you think each of their objectives are?
I think Biden's objective is not to go backwards, right? And Trump is going to start some craziness about the fact that Biden's on some sort of attention deficit drug, or he has a hearing aid with the answer to the questions. So say he's going to have some sort of road, you know, some off-ramp to get people confused, I guess. I don't know. It's entertaining anyway. But it shouldn't be entertaining. It should be, I mean, this is our country, right? This is the free world we're in about. So it really shouldn't be entertaining. It should be something that's informative and interesting.
Do you think that Biden should engage Trump at all? Like, for me, if I was debating Donald Trump, my response every time to anything that he said, attacking with judgments, conditions, false statements, facts, et cetera, would simply be, Mr. President, I appreciate your position. I pray for your happiness. Here's what I'm going to do. And totally not give him any engagement or energy and give him no place to go onto his shenanigans and utilize all the misinformation that he utilizes in order to evoke some sort of emotional response from people and separation that he's so brilliant at devising.
But those are the arrows in his quiver, right? He's emotive and he tries to build an emotional response to everything. He's not, you know, in my opinion, he's not the most well-read president we've ever had. He's not the most insightful president we've ever had. So the arrows in his quiver are all around attacking and around emotions. So he's going to keep on, you can try to stay calm, but it's not necessarily going to work. You've had arguments with people before, right? Where it's emotive.
Very much so. And, you know, you and I formulated this show and we thought, okay, who would be the best guest? And we had Trey on last week and he ends up winning an Emmy Award after our show. And here we have a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. But more importantly, Alan Miller is my first choice of guests that I wanted to bring on, because I think the biggest travesty in the last 4 years has been the loss of what's truly important to me, and it's the truth. And Alan has built a company and a platform far beyond when it was needed. It was, Yeah, years and years ago when nobody knew what he was doing, but he created the News Literacy Project, which recently launched an initiative to combat misinformation, never more needed than now. Also has a podcast that is called Is That a Fact? And they have a weekly newsletter called The Sift, all which are directed towards allowing people to determine their own opinion, but based on something that seems to be rare today called facts.
Well, he was 12 years ahead of fake news, David, right? He started this 12 years ahead of our whole fake news being in our consciousness every single moment of the day. And I think that what Alan's objective is to let all of us as parents and teachers know that it's our obligation to teach young people that they have to be able to understand how to navigate through fake news and get to the truth, regardless of what their opinion is. You and I, David, could have totally opposite opinions, but we both should be dealing with facts. We shouldn't be arguing our position based on made up information. I think what Alan's trying to do is educate our parents, and make them realize it's an obligation to teach young people how to navigate through the news. And it's much more difficult than it was when Alan and I were growing up, because, you know, we had the morning paper, the evening paper, the evening news, three ABC, NBC, CBS, BBC. You know, it wasn't 5,000 channels and 5,000 blogs and 5 million YouTube channels. So it was a little bit easier. But just because it's harder doesn't mean we can't do it, and doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. We have to do what Alan is trying to educate us all around, which is educating young people to be able to navigate through all this misinformation.
And, you know, everyone, you can put your questions in for Alan from LinkedIn, from Facebook. Just put it in the chat. We'll take some of those questions. But Alan, welcome to the McCourt and Meltzer Show. Get out and vote. And I'm sure you're as eager to inspire people to vote and hopefully be well informed when they vote. But, you know, David is right. You had some great vision about how important information and the facts are. What was your original motive when you created, you know, the first news literacy project? Because the issues weren't quite as big as they are today.
Yes, well, it's good to be with both of you. Thanks very much. So I started the News Literacy Project in 2008. And initially the idea arose when I went to speak to 175 sixth graders at my daughter's middle school about what I did as a journalist with the Los Angeles Times at the time and why it mattered. And that evening, Julia brought home 175 handwritten thank you notes so I could see what had resonated and what had connected and that I had not embarrassed her. And I was already concerned about two things. One was how she was evaluating this tsunami of sources of news and information of such varying credibility and accountability. And the other thing was the wrenching transition that was happening in the news business, the collapse of the business model for journalism, and whether there would continue to be an appreciation for quality journalism. So this was just at the start of iPhones, just at the start of Facebook, that I started NLP and helped found the field of news literacy.
Wow. And today, now that it's evolved from the sixth graders, I don't think there's a platform that's more important. But the issue is, how do we get people to join and use your platform, the podcast, the Sift? Because one of the things that I'm most fearful of is the intentional arrogance and ignorance and apathy that some of my hyper-intelligent friends are utilizing as an excuse to somehow ignore the facts.
So we did start, you know, focused on middle school and high school students, and we created a virtual classroom called Checkology, which is a cutting-edge, highly engaging platform that gives them a grounding in being able to discern what news and information to trust and to share and to be engaged and inform participants in democracy. We are now, that's now being used in schools throughout the country and with growing demand. We have recognized, however, that, as you said, David, there is a need for the general public to have these resources. So just recently, we have created a version of Checkology for the public, which is available at checkology.org, and a version of the weekly newsletter, The Sift, which takes that week's viral rumors, conspiracy theories, and hoaxes, and turns them into lessons, and we've created a version of that for the public called Get Smart About News. We have an app as well called Informable, which is a news literacy game that builds and tests news literacy skills that's available for people of all ages. So we have moved into the general public realm. We're also talking about the election. So I should mention that we have embarked on a PSA campaign in partnership with the Open Mind Legacy Project that is intended to combat misinformation seeking to suppress voting and to encourage people to get a wide range of sources, to check their facts, and also to understand that they cannot be told that you can vote by text or polling or virtually, or to look closely if they're told their polling place has closed or moved, and the fact the election can't be canceled or postponed. We know there was a tremendous effort to suppress voting, particularly in historically marginalized communities among young people and Black voters in 2016, and we want to help ensure that that does not is not effective this time around.
Alan, you know, your program that you started, what, I think 12 years ago, right? You started it in 2008. Eight, right? It reminds me a little bit. I had a TV show years ago called Reading Rainbow, which was basically a show. It was on PBS, but it was piped into all the classrooms around America to encourage kids to read. And it actually worked because kids that would come out of school in May or June would take them till the next Thanksgiving before they get up to the same level of reading because they didn't read over the summer. So it definitely works. Is your program, your methodology, is it finding its way into every school in America, or will it find its way into every school in America?
So we also know that what we're doing works because we've done a lot of assessment from early on. And so we know that students who do complete our lessons in Czechology become much more knowledgeable about the standards of quality journalism and what to look for and all the information they're consuming, much more knowledgeable about the role of a free press and the First Amendment and democracy. And they gain new tools as well. So we have gained considerable traction with that proof of concept. And we're now working with districts throughout the country, including the largest urban districts in New York City and Los Angeles, and then additional districts in places like North Carolina, South Carolina, Indiana, Missouri, Virginia, and elsewhere. And we've had thus far over 25,000 educators register to use Czechology with over 165,000 students. And we believe that's just the beginning in our effort to reach our vision, which is to see news literacy embedded in the American educational experience and among the general public.
You know,
fantastic goal.
Yeah, obviously the show's about getting out and voting, and you just briefly mentioned a really big issue, which is suppressing the votes. And like David said so eloquently last show that we did, you know, there's a third class that is underrepresented. You know, there's Democrats, Republicans, and then there's the socioeconomically challenged and handicapped. Like there's this third class of people that can be manipulated with misconceptions, misfacts, and truths. I would love for you to share, you know, beyond just you can text a vote and some others, just educating everyone on what some of those misconceptions are and where they're generated from. You know, a lot of people, I don't think, understand that what they see on Twitter not necessarily is true, or a video that's done so beautifully may actually be completely false. So if you could educate us on, you know, getting people the right information and then also letting them know where they can find the right information to help them get out and vote.
So, you know, we are flooded now, particularly in election season, you know, with news, opinion, and commentary, and social media posts, and images and video. And much of it is not intended to inform us or to give us the information to allow us to make up our own minds. Much of it is intended to inflame us and exploit us and divide us. And so it's really incumbent upon everybody to step back with anything that we see or read or hear and to ask ourselves, what are we looking at? You know, who created this? Can we tell? For what purpose? Is this intended to inform us? Or is it intended to invoke our emotions, because very often if we feel anger or fear or even joy, that is an opportunity for us to be manipulated when we're emotionally engaged. And then to ask, what's the evidence? What's the supporting documentation? Is there bias here? To look and see, is it in more than one place? Is this a single source? To get a wide array of sources. And then to follow news and the story over time, because it often takes time for truth to emerge. And then to ask ourselves, what's our own bias? Are we looking for something that's confirmation or information? And then finally to ask ourselves, whether it's about voting or about the pandemic or about the Black Lives Matter protests, should I trust this? Should I share this? Should I act on it?
Alan, you were a journalist for a long time, a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist. Has it always been this way? When you started out, were journalists more middle of the road? Were journalists more about the information rather than trying to persuade people of their personal point of views? Or has it always been this way?
So look, what's changed so dramatically, of course, is the internet and digital media, right? Now we have an explosion. It's no longer about journalists who are essentially gatekeepers. Now there's been a democratization of the process, which is a great advance. I mean, everybody's voice can be heard. It's no longer top down. But by the same token, there's no barriers to entry. There's no guardrails. There's no standard for much as what is being produced. So I think that there still remains a lot of quality journalism that is seeking to truly inform people in a dispassionate and accurate way. Journalism's imperfect by its nature, but it is competing for everybody's attention with so much else. And that's why I think so much of the onus is on the consumer, and that we all need to be upstanders for facts. We all need to be mindful of what we're consuming and sharing and become part of an information solution instead of the misinformation problem.
Alan, why can't journalists have like a rating system when some independent body, every time a journalist says something that's not true, they get some sort of rating demotion or some sort of tick mark, so that if I'm reading something from the LA Times, where you worked for a long, long time, or the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, is some sort of rating system. So I know that Alan Miller at the LA Times, you know, has impeccable credentials for reporting the facts.
So I would say that news organizations, reputable news organizations, have standard and a level of accountability. When mistakes are made, they should be corrected. And if journalists actually make things up, there are serious consequences, including loss of their job and their career. And it's imperfect by its nature. There's a reason it's called the first rough draft of history. But by the same token, you can contrast it with so much else, most of what else is out there that doesn't have standards, that doesn't have accountability. And so, but even again, because even the most reputable outlets make mistakes and bias can seep in, we don't tell students or the public to trust any one source or not trust another. We want to give them the critical thinking skills to make those judgments on their own about what they encounter and wherever they encounter it.
You know, Alan, you started this with a bunch of sixth graders, and I have four children of my own, looking at the effect of misinformation. And it's not just the facts themselves. What I'm most concerned about is when I grew up, there was can you hear me? When I grew up, I'm still growing up. But I'm worried because the truth was so important, to find the truth, to know the truth. And what impact do you think all of this misinformation is going to have for the next few decades compared to people who seek the truth? Does it create apathy, anger, separate? What are the effects of people not knowing the truth and not having someone to rely on?
So I'm really concerned about that point. I believe we're at an inflection point where it's not certain that facts are going to continue to matter. And they matter because of the basis what we teach in our schools, for our scientific inquiry and findings, and for our public policy debates and decisions. So if they're in trouble, so is democracy. And I think that this is why we really need a change in sort of our mindset about how we approach news and information. I like to quote the poker champion, Eric Seidel, who says, less certainty, more inquiry. And so I think we need a lot less certainty about what we are trusting and more inquiry, particularly before we share it. And I do think you mentioned to me earlier about where can people go to learn more. I mean, they can learn a lot more about us. And all of our resources are free, by the way, at newslit.org. And we have a special page on election misinformation and information, which is newslit.org/election2020, which is another place that people can go.
Alan, what made you start this business? I know the story you told at the beginning, but you must have had when you were a journalist, there must have been something else that made you say this business has to be started.
So I've been a journalist in effect since I was in the sixth grade. You know, I've been doing journalism early on and edited a middle school newspaper, founded one, edited my high school newspaper, done four internships. And then I had a long career, 29 years, doing everything I wanted to do in journalism and more. I was a witness to history. In some respects, I helped to make some history. And I think, you know, I had an enduring belief in not only the value of journalism, but in the value of the standards of journalism, to use them as a yardstick against which to measure all news and information, and the ability and the importance of teaching people in an information age how to think like journalists, because we're all our own editor and we all can be our own publisher. And so I was concerned about whether the public would continue to play those roles in ways that were credible and responsible and empower their voices, starting with the next generation and then the public writ large. So that was, I think, kind of and I was concerned about the next generation's ability to navigate on the most fraught information landscape in human history, and whether there would continue to be an appreciation for the kind of quality journalism, you know, that I and so many others have devoted our careers to. So that's really what drove me, David, in terms of establishing NLP.
So, and Alan, since the whole educational system has just blown up with COVID, right? We've sort of taken a 30-year advancement, whether we like it or not. We might not have caught up with the advancement, but the world sort of went 30 years ahead with COVID on home learning and how education has to be rethought. So isn't it total rethink here is that we just have to put this into the curriculum from day one, that teaching young people how to absorb news is a critical skill, like math, like spelling, like history. Isn't that the only answer?
I couldn't agree more. I mean, we believe it's a survival skill in today's fraud.
But it's not only a survival skill for the young kid, it's a survival skill for the country.
True. Yes.
If people are going to watch this debate tonight, they're going to come away. We're going to read the papers tomorrow, and we're going to read articles of two different people's views that are going to be as if they were watching a different show. Like it's going to be like it's not going to be like who shot JR. It's going to be crazy.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the democracy is founded upon an informed and engaged electorate. And to go back to David's earlier question about what's the impact of what we're seeing, I mean, part of the impact is that, you know, people are losing trust in some cases in everything. Trust in the news media, trust in government institutions across the board. They don't know what to believe. We see that in survey after survey. For many, they're locked in their filter bubbles and they're believing, you know, what they are inclined to believe, what they feel, what they're learning from sources that they go to that they know they will agree with, as opposed to challenging their beliefs. And that has further a hyperpolarization that we see in the country, and that's having such disastrous consequences. So we need people to get out of those bubbles, to get a wider range of views, to be more critical and mindful in what they consume, and then particularly in terms of what they share, because none of us would want to infect our friends or our family with the virus of misinformation. But many of us are doing it not consciously, but inadvertently, by sharing things we haven't checked out or haven't questioned. So I think I couldn't agree more that I think the critical thinking skills that are embedded in news literacy should be required in state standards throughout the country and be made a cornerstone of our education system.
And how can the two Davids help you? Because that's what we need to do. I think you got the goal and objective, right?
Indeed. Well, you know, we are a small, if growing, educational nonprofit. We are nonpartisan, and we're certainly looking for new partners and participants and patrons to help us grow our capacity and grow our reach and impact at this critical moment. And so I would encourage those who are watching and listening, and those you know, to get in touch with me and to get engaged, to become part of our mission and help us achieve that ambitious vision.
And Melvin, you gave all his handles out earlier, right, of how to contact him?
And in the notes too, newslit.org. And is there anywhere else to contact you, Alan?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter at Alan Miller NLP. I'm happy to give out, my email too, if you think that would be helpful.
Sure. Please do. If you're okay with it. I do.
Okay. So it's amiller@newslit.org. And if people want to get engaged, please feel free to reach out to me.
That's all. One last question before I let you go. Is it too late? You know, a lot of the issues that we deal with, from equality, socioeconomic issues that we have, and David wrote a book called Rethink, and educational, financial, political, all these different systems need to be rethought out. But is it too late that we can never get back to being able to rely on the media and rely on the truth?
Well, you know, it's a huge challenge. I'm certainly not Pollyannish about what we face, but I get up every morning, as do my staff and others who are working with us, convinced that this is a fight that we need to wage. You know, the stakes are very high here. We're talking about the education of the next generation. We're talking about the future of quality journalism, because you're going to have to build a demand for it to continue to exist, and ultimately for the health of the country's democracy. And so I don't think it's too late. I think that there was 2016 was a watershed. We learned so much in the wake of the election about what was happening on the social media platforms, about the Russian disinformation campaign, that we saw a surge in interest in financial support, in media interest, in educator interest in what we're doing. And I'm hopeful now, in the midst of the pandemic, where it's not just a matter of the public life of the country, but it's public health, in the midst of this election, that we will continue to see that support grow, and that we can create a movement where people do become upstanders for facts and part of an information solution. And that's the way to combat this scourge, this growing tsunami of misinformation.
And Alan, that last week's guest won an Emmy the next day, so I assume you'll win a Pulitzer Prize in the morning, and you'll thank the two Lucky Charms here, the two Davids.
Right, the two Lucky Charms.
I would take an influx of new partners and supporters coming off of them would be my reward.
I hope he wins a Nobel Peace Prize, because that means that he actually effectuated what his vision was 12 years ago. So that would be a blessing for all of us if you could win that. So I certainly appreciate, from the day I met you, what you're doing and all the great organizations that support you. And please, everyone out there, in the notes where to reach out, support Alan and NewsLit. It's an incredible organization, maybe at the heart of the survival, not just of this election, but any future elections that exist. So thank you so much.
Thank you both very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, Alan. Thank you.
Right on. All right. Now we get to the nitty gritty, because this guy, he knows the inside out of the social media game when it comes to politics. He's a mentor of mine. I've utilized some of the skills, knowledge, and techniques that he used to win campaigns on the social media front with building a brand, because that's basically what Philip Stutz does. Philip, welcome to the McCourt and Meltzer McCourt Get Out and Vote show. You got to get
user techniques. It's the D&D show. First of all, this is the greatest name of a show ever. Whether you guys realize it or not, personally, I love it, because I was the national Get Out the Vote director for President Bush's reelection in 2004. So this, I love this. So I'm ready to roll.
So we were going to offer up the name, the brand, to you, Philip, back then, but it was a big difference between the bid and the ask, so we kept it for ourselves.
There you go. I love it. How do you want to jump in today?
Hey, Phil, can I ask you a question? What if what's better, political marketing or product marketing? Like, if I had a product, should I be hiring a political marketer? Or if I'm a politician, should I be hiring a consumer products marketer? Like, okay. What's the difference?
Yeah, it's virtually impossible for a consumer marketer to go into politics. There are they have tried and tried and tried over the years. There are few exceptions.
They're not good enough liars?
No, everything in our business of marketing and politics is about the relationship you have. And unless you've been in the battle for decades, then no politician is going to trust to hire any kind of marketer for the most part. On the other hand, I've transitioned my business into seven figures at this point and from going from political marketer to corporate marketer. Here's the great thing, Dave. It's a great question. The fundamentals are the same. The execution's crazily different. And I learned that lesson early on. But the fundamentals are very unique and very important for corporations or companies to utilize and how we look at political.
Is there like a closed little circle of group of is a closed group of you that do all the political marketing? Is it a relevant group?
That's right. It's a very, very insular group.
And do you, if you work for Bush, does that mean you only work for Republicans or you work for either?
So it's a really good question. I would tell you up until about 2016, you had to choose a side. Since 2016, whether you love him or hate him, Trump has disrupted the entire model, including the business model of our business. And so we are now working for Democrats for the first time ever. Some Democrats that we align with. I think right now it's not about party, it's about alignment. And so we've done a lot of work, especially on the education front. So we support African Americans that believe in school choice, educational charter schools, vouchers, those types of things. So we've worked with African American Democratic candidates all over the country that support those types of issues. So it's really about issues and alignment right now.
And when I was, David, before, when I was saying the lie, I wasn't talking about the marketers, by the way. I was talking about the politicians. I wasn't throwing your industry on the bus. I was throwing the politicians under the bus.
Oh, you're good. You can throw me under the bus. It doesn't matter.
Even as someone that works for them, you have to admit they are a little loose with the truth as a breed.
Yes, in general. And then you go meet with one and you go, God, I like that lady. You know, I mean, if you meet with them one-on-one, it's a totally different feeling than the way that the general public believes in the politician right now.
You know, what's so funny about that, Philip, is I, as a young man, used to sell like a politician. I was an overseller, back-end seller, liar, manipulator, cheater, and everybody loved me. So they're very likable. That's the problem when you're overselling and manipulating people. It's a tool. But how important, though, you know, I'm trying to get a gauge. You've been around over 20 years in the business, traditional, into the digital marketing and media side of it with Win Big, and you do win big, and you know the inner game. How important in this election is social media? How, you know, are the commercials at all effective comparative to what is going on? And how still manipulative is Trump in what he does? Because he's a genius when it comes to utilizing, you know, the audience on social media and driving them through all types of different divisive ways to do what he wants them to do.
Well, the medium is something. That's a great question, David. Look, the platforms have changed insanely. 4 years ago, Facebook was a persuasion platform. Okay, you went to Trump. A great example. I'm writing my second book right now, but I'm using this in the book, which is in 16. Trump would his digital team would run one ad, 162 ways, different fonts, different backgrounds, different people, men, women, and then they would find whatever ad, you know, sort of got organic growth, and then they just put lighter fluid on it. And that was really their strategy for the most part. Facebook sat down with both Hillary's campaign and Trump's campaign in 2015, 2016 and said, welcome to our world. You get whatever you want. Trump went all in on it. Hillary said, don't want to even deal with you guys at Facebook. Screw you. We're good to go. And it ended up benefiting Trump tremendously. But here's what's changed since then. Facebook is not a place to persuade anymore. I would say 95% of the dollars on Facebook right now are to raise money from people that already support the candidates, because Facebook has made it so hard to get a message out, and they put so many restrictions. Whether, you know, what you see is not the campaign's ads for the most part, but even if you see an ad and you go, oh, they're trying to convince me. No, they're not. They're trying to get you in their funnel, and they're trying to raise money, both Biden and Trump. And so really the only places that you're seeing this is sort of in pre-roll ads, but also YouTube ads. That's where the persuasion is sort of happening right now. Facebook is almost exclusively used to raise money for the candidates.
Is that bad? Is that mean bad things to come for Facebook going forward? Or is that just the little niche that they cut out for themselves?
But say it again. I had a hard time hearing you.
What does that mean for Facebook going forward, Philip?
They're moving away from the politics as a business model, the politics of persuasion as a business model. I have a partnership with the largest data collection, analytics, and AI company in America. We are constantly looking at 200 plus million Americans, 550 million plus connected devices, and we're tracking 10 billion online decisions every day. We just are about to release a study on Friday for free to people. And what we found is right now, looking at the numbers, 72.3% of Americans don't trust the news that's coming out of Facebook right now. They know this is a problem. It is a problem. And they're going to try to move their business model probably away from it in the future.
You know a lot of data, Philip. One of the things that nobody's talking about, we're trying to get a guide on, is, you know, both parties have a big base, meaning no matter what's going to be said tonight or beyond tonight, they're not changing their mind. What percentage do you think is still up for grabs? You know, where does that lie? Have you seen the data as far as where you see the swing could exist?
Yeah, it's only about 5 or 7 percentage points, 7 on the very high end. I would not even put it at 7. I put it at 5. So here's the thing. I live in Florida. Michael Bloomberg is running $100 million worth of ads in Florida right now. To swing, 5% is national. What if in Florida it's at 3%? So it's incredibly inefficient. This is why businessmen that run for office or businesswomen that run for office go, why would I do this? It's the most inefficient thing I've ever done in my life, because the swing is so small. The key to the whole thing is who gets out to vote, because right now 98% of Trump voters are motivated to vote on election day or between now and election day, and 96% of Joe Biden supporters are motivated. Here's the key. I believe it's 72%, according to the data we've been looking at, are motivated to vote for Trump on the Republican side. Only 48% our Democrats are motivated to vote for Biden. Their motivation is to vote against Trump. So what happens? And, you know, obviously I understand get out the vote. What happens to that motivation on election day? I'm convinced, guys, look, we've seen the data. We've already seen the data now that Trump has a built-in 1 to 3 percentage points of people that aren't identifying as Trump supporters in the polling, okay? And think about these target states. So if you see Biden up 5 or 10 points, he's got a little cushion. If you see it basically even going into election day, Trump's got some hidden vote in there, because people are afraid they're going to get canceled if they say they vote for Trump. And one other factor that no one is reporting on right now, and is so key to the title of this show, which is that the Trump team has knocked on over 100 million doors at this point. Okay. In the last, I think, 2 weeks, they've knocked on 10 million doors. And what I mean by that is you have volunteers knocking on doors of the people they know are going to vote for Trump, not unknown voters, not registered voters. They know these people are going to vote, and they're reminding them because they got to turn them out. Joe Biden's team has said that is not their priority. They are not going to put a ground game in effect. And so I am not saying that that gets Trump 5 points on election day. It doesn't. It's like in a football game, it's like a field goal, not a touchdown, right? But it should buy Trump another point. That's it. 1 point. So if you're looking at this, I just think that on election day, Trump has an inherent, we don't know, 2 to 4 points that'll show up. Is that enough? I'm not sure it is.
Philip, what happened to what I've heard you call the Bernie Bros before? Like, what happens to all these young kids that seem so passionate for Bernie? I guess I have two questions. Why were they so passionate for Bernie? Because he's an old white guy, and the old white guys have been running the country, with the exception of Obama, for, you know, a long time, and we haven't done such a great job. So why were they so infatuated with him, number one? And number two, how do we get them out to vote? Regardless of whether they're going to vote, who they're going to vote for, how do we get them out to vote?
Yeah, great question. Yeah, I don't care what people tell you. Young people just don't vote. I mean, they go, oh, no, this is going to be the youth election. And maybe it is, but that is like literally less than a point more than what has been historically seen. As far as the Bernie Bros and that turnout, you know, it's going to be interesting. Listen, I don't think the Bernie Bros, they represent a certain amount of votes. I would have to go back. David, maybe you guys have seen how many votes Bernie got total. I would say it was probably less than 30 million. So of those, how many were Bernie Bros versus people that were just dissatisfied or just like them? So how many is that? Is that 10 million? Is it 12 million? Or is it less than that? Well, in 2016, we had 137 million voting people that voted, right? We're predicting this time it's going to be 145 to 150 million. So is that potentially the difference in some of these key states? Absolutely. Could it mean nothing? It absolutely could do that. How do you turn those people out? I don't know. They're not motivated for Biden, but they hate Trump. So that's why every ad you see, for the most part, is from Biden's campaign or his super PACs is an attack on Trump, because they're not trying to convince anybody. This is the secret. They're trying to motivate their base.
So, you know, it's so interesting because I saw the commercials last night from the NFL and started thinking about how influencers, you know, are speaking to young people. And here you have the most popular sport in America, 2-1 for men and women. And they had a huge campaign about only 60% of the people voted last election. And I thought it was a good, powerful campaign about, hey, I'll only block for you 60% of the time. How's that sound? You know, and what an impact, though, does that really have? Because I'm interested, you know, influencers like the Kardashians and, you know, have so much force, but can those type of commercials and campaigns on digital media actually motivate people to vote, let alone the young people?
No.
They can't. That's the biggest takeaway. That's a big takeaway.
This is an easy sports question. Who's that champs behind you? What team is that?
The Nationals, the Washington Nationals. That's my team.
That's
so you're, and I got a hold on, and I got a Nick Saban helmet right behind me right here. So, David Meltzer, let me say this: people vote for out of fear, and people vote for whatever their own belief system is. A celebrity may be able to sell products; it may be able to get you clicks. But it won't move the needle in politics. In fact, it probably sometimes has a counter effect, is what we've seen is when all these celebrities come out for these Democratic politicians, I've seen this on the Republican side, it has motivated our base to vote even higher because they want to shove it down their throats that their candidate wins. So I have never seen it be that effective, but yet every year they roll them out. And I kind of laugh deep inside of me.
Wow.
So the young vote, the pressing priority is you're saying right now the young people aren't going to vote again.
Yes, right. Absolutely.
That's a huge, huge takeaway.
I didn't get your answer to why all the young people like Bernie so much. I didn't understand that answer. Or I didn't hear it.
Why do they like Bernie so much?
Why did they? Or I guess
yeah, because I believe that if you look at some of the polling, the younger generation, the 18 to 25, the Gen Z generation believes, yeah, they have this sort of belief at there's a more equitable and fair system. And there's only one candidate that was speaking of that. And they don't like their parents' generation. They think they're all a bunch of greedy, you know, SOBs. So for the most part, it's tapping into the angst of that generation. And he does it. He's done. But he also has the here's the thing about Bernie. Love him or hate him, he's authentic. He is who he is. He's always been authentic. He's not. I tell you the counter to that. Cory Booker. Whether you like him or hate him, he's been running for presidency. He was the mayor of Newark, New Jersey in 2004 or 5 or whenever he won. Like, and he changes his positions. Bernie is who he is. He's been that way since the 80s. And people were always respond more to authenticity in candidates than they do to inauthenticity. That doesn't mean that inauthentic candidates don't win. They do. But when you have a big stage with 12, 16 candidates, authenticity shines. Why did Andrew Yang, although he didn't win a lot of votes, why did he jump up in the national polls so much? Why did he build the Yang army? Because people saw that authenticity. And they didn't. They look through. You know, why do they connect somewhat with Biden? Well, they trust him. They trust that they believe he's authentic, and the ability to trust him. And I figure, you know, it doesn't mean they trust the whole person, but they could trust an attribute, and that can give them enough to support that.
So why did Biden do so bad? And also, why is he still putting money in TV ads in Florida, or if he put a gazillion dollars in TV ads everywhere else and they didn't work?
Wait. Say, all right, hold on. Why did Biden do so bad?
I meant Bloomberg. Sorry, I meant to say Bloomberg.
Oh, yeah, he didn't. And they did absolutely. They saw him as a carpetbagger that came in at the last second and thought he was going to buy the election. And then, if you don't remember, David, there were all these allegations of sexual harassment at his company, and he did not answer it for in a open and honest manner. He wouldn't release people out of NDAs. And in the middle and the height of the primary, that was a massive issue that literally destroyed him.
So that the Me Too movement was a big part of it then?
Huge. Yes. He was doing okay. He was right up there in the top tier, the top two or three. Something had to either thrust him up or something had to knock him down. He got knocked down in those debates. The candidates ran ads against him. And it crushed him.
Elizabeth Warren took him on that issue, right out of the box, right?
That's right.
And I meant to say Bloomberg. Yeah. So why is Bloomberg putting so much money in TV ads in Florida when his TV ads didn't really work?
It's a really good question, because he's got more money, knows what to do with, and he doesn't care about wasting it. Honestly, he doesn't care. I mean, he spent $13 million on anti-gun rights ads or gun control ads in the 2018 election cycle. He didn't win anywhere. He is just willing to shove it all in and do what he wants to do. I kind of respect that he believes in these things. He's going out after it. I just don't think he's been effective.
Yeah, last question, Philip, because I'm curious. If Biden would hire you, what's the one or best piece of advice you would give him today of what he should do differently?
It's a great question. And the advice I would give him has a double-edged sword. And that is, he needs to get out of the damn basement. He needs to get out there and he knows to show voters, because tonight we're going to see in the debates. How does he handle himself? He's got two more after that. They literally, on average, he is cutting off his schedule by 9 a.m. every single day over the last week. They can say it's debate prep, but this has been consistent. He has been in his basement for months. Get him out. Eventually, that is going to cascade against him. It was a smart strategy in the summer. Let it all be on Trump. But I would tell you, you can't hide him forever. He's got to go out there. He's got to be out amongst people. He's got to be seen. He's got to be talking more. He's got to be laying out positions. If he's not, maybe he's not able to do that. I can't tell. And that's the big question on voters' minds that are still left, that have not decided on who they're going to vote for. There's a lot that they believe they need to know on Trump, but they're like the economy and COVID and vaccine. But for Biden, it's like, Are you hiding or are you not? It's going to backfire unless they get him out more.
Wow. I just have to tell you, Dave McCourt, you know, this to me, the insight that I got, you know, I love when people change my perception and really give me an inside scoop. Both Alan and Philip, you guys were terrific. I learned so much, and hopefully other people have learned too, and hopefully it motivates them to get out and vote. Dave, any last takeaways for you?
No, I think this has been unbelievably educational for me personally, and I hope if we did anything, David, I hope we can sell the Meltzer McCourt get out and vote name to Philip so he can use it with his campaigns, and we get a little residual on that. But I just hope we got somebody, 1, 2, 5, 10, 100, 1,000, some amount of people to say, okay, I'm going to go out and vote no matter what. Even if I have to wait in line, even if it's cold, even if it's windy, I'm going to go out and vote. I've never not voted since I was eligible to vote. Never not voted.
What? Hold on, before I go, what's your prediction? Both of you, I want to know.
For tonight or for the election?
Well, if the election were held today.
Biden would win, and it won't be overwhelming enough probably for to stop all the swirl, but it'll be overwhelming. It'll be a clear enough victory that the movers will come, pack up 1600 Pennsylvania Ave, and Trump will go back to New York.
He ain't going back to New York. He's going to get indicted there. He's going
no, he'll be
enough.
Indicted immediately. He's going to go to Ireland and live with McCourt.
They wouldn't let him in.
All right, Meltzer, what's your prediction?
Yeah, I think Biden wins, but no matter by what margin, and I don't think it'll be a big margin if it was today, Trump's going to try to stay by utilizing what he's built with Mitch in the courts. You know, there's so many people that he's put into those court systems that he's such an expert at utilizing the law in his favor. You know, I think we're going to have a difficult time getting him out by inauguration, but, you know, hopefully it won't take military force. Hopefully it'll be a peaceful surrender and, you know, more, I think, intelligent minds will come to bear. But I think Biden will win and hopefully we'll get him out.
Great. Hey, as we get close to the election, if y'all want to nerd out on the Electoral College vote and have a bunch of predictions and stuff, let me know. I'll come back on.
We may have that back. Trust me.
Always up for nerd now.
Enjoy it, guys.
Thank you, my brother.
Philip, thank you so much. This was very, very, very helpful. And I hope somewhere in your collection of champs there, you have Brady, the Patriots, the Celtics, the Red Sox.
David, my wife is from Massachusetts. We met in D.C. and we live in Florida now. Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, I know that story. I know that. There
you go. All right, my brother. See y'all.
See you later. So much. Thanks.
Oh, my gosh. Tampa Bay got Brady and the Stanley Cup. What more do they ask? I landed in Boston one time, Dave. You know, I'm a San Diego fan. So the billboard read, it's been 110 days since our last championship.
That's hysterical. That's
painful. Hysterical. It was embarrassing. Well,
I stayed up till 3 a.m. watching the Celtics lose in the last 4 minutes.
Oh, that was painful too. Welcome to being a San Diego fan. Then we at least made the baseball playoffs. We'll see what happens. But all three guests that we've had on this show. Wow. That's all I have to say. Wow. Huh? Really great.
Unbelievable. Really, really unbelievable. And look, Your man there trying to solve all the school problems. We got to figure out how to help him out. You know, we got to figure out how to help him out, because Alan is like doing God's work. I mean, I wish he had started it when he was 15, but he's doing God's work there, trying to educate kids about how to navigate through the news. It's difficult.
Yeah, it's almost nearly impossible, but unless we're trying, we're dying. So let's keep on trying. But most importantly, get out and vote. Listen to the election. Remember, trust and vet. That's my policy in business. Whenever I meet someone, I give them my initial trust, but I always vet. We have to get in the habit of vetting people. So trust and vet what you hear tonight and make the best decision for yourself. But most importantly, get out and vote.
Couldn't agree with you more, David. And thanks again. Once again, we're doing our part anyway, right? We're doing something.
Doing something, doing our best. Thank you, everyone.
Either the Meltzer McCourt get out and vote, are we going to be like John and Yoko and just go in bed until people get out and vote? But I wasn't willing to problem with the covers with you, David. So this was the best choice I had. Best choice we had.
That's awesome. The two Julies would be jealous. But till next week, my friend, I'll talk to you soon. Thank you, everyone, for joining us.
All right. Thanks. God bless. Thanks, David.
God bless. Bye-bye. Take care, guys. Hey, podcast listeners, thank you for listening, as always, to today's episode. I know you've been enjoying the Road to Revenue episodes. They are downloading at record paces, and I am so grateful for you joining me, not only on the podcast, but live every Friday at 11 a.m. Pacific time, 2 p.m. Eastern. Make sure you email me at david@dmeltzer.com or text me at 949-298-2905. Thank you so much.